This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Disgust is a natural reaction, and it's a good thing we have it because it protects us from dangerous contamination, poisonous substances. But disgust also influences our moral judgments. And so what's the connection? Well, just listen to the language that we use to condemn bad behavior.
You're a big boy. What's your name?
Paul.
And what can I get you for Christmas?
Don't tell him what you want. He's a liar. Let the kid talk. You disgust me. How can you live with yourself?
Just cool it, Zippy.
You sit on a throne of lies.
Well, what could be more disgusting than Santa Claus? That's from the movie Elf, of course. So when disgust speaks to our moral and our political leanings, it might not always be rational. Here to help us reflect on disgust is Cornell psychology professor David Pizarro, who is the currently Kahan Distinguished Visiting Professor at Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill. David Pizarro, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So when we think about this business of disgust, first of all, we should say it is a very normal thing. It's adaptive. We've got it because it helped get us here, right?
It's very adaptive. It's what keeps you from putting potential poisons in your mouth. And you can see it very early on. If you put a bitter substance in a baby, it will try to stick its tongue out and get it out. And that's the early origins of disgust. And then it expands. But it's definitely a good emotion.
All right, so that's a good emotion. But it's very closely correlated when I say disgust to things that we see that are kind of slimy, pussy, a little ambiguous in their qualities, or also smell bad, right?
Or smell bad, vision, even sounds are enough to get that disgust reaction going. And maybe we know somebody who just saying a word can get them to gag. Right.
And we're very good at this. We use language in ways and we make comparisons, metaphors, analogies. That's what we do as humans. And very often, if we don't like something, we compare it to something disgusting. That also seems pretty normal.
And the power of disgust is that it's one of the easiest emotions to evoke. And that's sort of the secret answer to why I started studying it. I mean, you bring somebody into the lab and with one image, one sentence, you can get it. You can get them to have this full-blown reaction that's very strong. And that's one reason it's so good for rhetoric and political moral rhetoric.
So you did a great test, I think, and it involves the sense of smell, where you walked up to people with a clipboard and started asking questions. Tell us about it.
Right. Well, there were two. In one, we brought people into the laboratory and asked them a bunch of questions. And for half of those people, there was a foul smell in the room. So we had to rotate this every other day. We had this foul smell in the room, and we asked them to rate a bunch of social groups that included immigrants, African Americans, the elderly, and we were really interested in this connection between their judgments of gay men and the disgust evoking qualities of that smell. And what we found was that on the days that there was a foul, disgusting smell in the room, people were more negative in their evaluations of gay men. But we also, the flip side of this is that the best explanation for what disgust is doing is it's keeping us clean. It's keeping us away from disease. So another way that you can do that is by just reminding people that they need to wash their hands, that the flu season is around. And so in one study, all we did was give people a one-page questionnaire about their political orientation. And we either did it in front of a Purell dispenser or we did it on the other side of the hallway. And we found that people were more harsh in their judgments of sexual deviance, but also more politically conservative, and that ties in with the other work that we've done.
All right, so let's connect a few dots here, and then we'll move on to this political connection. So disgust, then, is linked to the idea of contamination. The things we're disgusted at perhaps are contaminated and shouldn't be ingested. So the mere suggestion of contamination, you can influence people's behavior or outcomes without the disgusting artifact.
Right. And so there are a group of researchers that study this sort of disease avoidance mechanisms. And disgust is one aspect of this motivation. And it makes sense. It's not a perfect mechanism. Obviously, we did not have a good theory of what causes disease, in early human history. But the amazing thing is how well it does track those kinds of things that would reliably get us sick. And one of the principles by which it works is this principle of contamination. So if you touch something that I find disgusting, I now find you disgusting. Think about the other emotions. They don't really work that way. If you're next to something that makes me afraid, I'm not really now afraid of you. Or if you're standing next to somebody that makes me angry, I'm not now angry of you. But disgust is tracking through this contamination principle before we even had a germ theory of disease.
Wow. So there you go. So that's the early adaptation of this. But when we say it's a human condition, we all sense some kind of disgust. But we're on a spectrum. Some of us are more likely to or easily disgusted than others.
We are. And I'm sure some of your listeners with just the mention of some of the things that you were talking about, the slimy things, and were cringing. And some have no idea why anybody would care that much. And so you can actually measure this. And some researchers at Pennsylvania developed a scale to measure this, where you simply ask people a series of questions about in everyday life. Imagine that, say, you were to walk into a public toilet and it was unflushed. How grossed out would you be? And it turns out that this predicts actual behavior. If you bring people into the laboratory and you ask them if they're willing to do a task, like one of our favorites is you bake some chocolate in the shape of dog feces. And you simply ask people, are you willing to eat this? And not surprisingly, perhaps, people who report having high what we call disgust sensitivity, people who are easily disgusted, are much less likely to be willing to engage in those tasks. So there is a spectrum.
And are those sensitivities correlated? For instance, can you be highly sensitive to disgust visually but not so much olfactory or smell, sense of smell?
So there is some evidence that it seems to cluster, not so much by the modality, but and there's actually not enough research on that. This is a very good question about whether smell and sight might be different. But at least in the domain, so there is some evidence that there is an interpersonal contamination. So I'm grossed out that I sipped on a soda that turns out not to be mine. Other human beings versus just what many researchers call core disgust, which is those things that you shouldn't put in your mouth, like those basics, rotten meat, feces, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, because the average 10-year-old boy has a very high threshold for disgusting pictures. There's no amount of mutilation they can't take in general, and yet they might be very easily put off by a smell.
Exactly.
Although they generate many of them.
They generate many. You know, and it's not just 10-year-old boys. We always laugh at, you know, when I get college sophomore males are also quite comfortable with the very disgusting.
Well, there's no distinction actually between a 10-year-old boy and a college
that's
sophomore.
Right. Oh, you're talking mental age.
That's a whole other story. All right. So now we've done it. We've established that there is a spectrum of disgust behavior and reaction. So how does this relate then to politics? This is very interesting that there is a correlation between our political leanings.
In order to tell the story, I'll say first that we weren't expecting this relationship. We were studying this individual difference in disgust sensitivity and the degree to which how easily you're grossed out. And we just happened to toss in some political orientation items. So simply a very, very simple question on a scale of 1 to 7, 7 being very politically conservative, 1 being very politically liberal. Where do you rank? And we kept finding this consistent relationship that people who were very easily disgusted were more likely to say they were politically conservative. Another way of saying that is that if you're very liberal, you're not very easily disgusted. Right? Mm-hmm. And so when we did follow-up studies, we've collected data on thousands upon thousands of people across the world, and we see this general relationship that people who are easily grossed out tend to be more on the political conservative side.
And when you say that, are we talking about, is there a distinction between fiscal conservatives and social issues?
There is. When you actually ask the questions, it turns out that it does not seem to track fiscal conservatism. It really seems to track the kind of political conservatism that's more in the social moral domain.
And that, of course, is all about contamination. If it's race mixing, if it's genders and sexuality.
Exactly. Especially sexuality always gives us some of the strongest relationships. And yeah, exactly. There is a general tendency in the literature we find on the literature on just what makes somebody conservative versus liberal. There's a lot of research showing that people who are conservative, almost by definition here, don't like novel things and don't like change. And they're very sensitive to threat. So new things are possibly threatening. We don't know yet. And so the conservative mind is one that is much more on alert about threat. And disgust seems to be in that domain.
All right, I'm going to mess up your research right now because a lot of progressives are deeply concerned about the environment, the contamination of the air, contamination of the water, and they're very conservative. They would like to see our waterways conserved, our forests conserved. They don't want to see this change that would turn into urban sprawl that many conservatives can profit by. So what does that do to your theory?
I think that you're absolutely right to point that out, and I think that one of the things that we can't do too much is to say that politically liberal and conservative are these sort of natural human distinctions. A lot of why we get what we get is because the conservative movement, especially in the United States, chose to focus on certain issues, and they used emotions very effectively in order to convince people of this, of say the moral claims that the religious right was making. it is, we are all human beings, and we all are able to feel disgust. And a colleague of mine, Yoel Imbar, is actually looking at this very thing, and he's starting to get findings that, yes, in fact, that area of liberal politics is very, very related to the disgust response.
All right, but why doesn't it work as well? Why can't we say, why couldn't a progressive say to a conservative, fossil fuels are killing you, they're contaminating you, they're disgusting, and that would scare the heck out of the conservative, and they'd say, we need to move to renewables as soon as we can.
Right, and you point to one of the things that really is important, that these issues are there is no way in which just the simple tendency to feel disgust could account for the variability in political belief. There's so much else that's added on to these extra layers that we pay attention. You're conservative, you pay attention to something and you willfully ignore something else. You dismiss it. And so the answer to why we are what we are politically can't simply be.
So that's when I have to actually bring Dan Ariely into the conversation with you, David. And then we have this kind of full of, what about, you talked about the fact that I don't have to have the disgusting thing there, just the suggestion of antibiotic hand cream or something.
Right.
How about facial expressions? Is there, because I'm thinking like Nancy Grace, right? If I look at Nancy, she's always like sucking on a hairball. She's got that fit. She's got a look of disgust on her face. And I am like pro death penalty when I look at her because somebody must die. And that expression has an influence on me. Can the expression on your face engender in me a feeling of disgust?
The expression on your face, it's such a powerful way of communicating emotion. And we've known this since Darwin. What those emotions that you're carrying on your face are signals, they're messages that you're giving me. It's not that it's making me feel disgust, but what it's doing is alerting me that something in the environment might be dangerous or threatening. Now, if you're looking at me with disgust, then that's an extra powerful signal that you don't like me. And in fact, the look of contempt, which is very similar to disgust, is one of the best predictors that a couple is going to break up. If one person looks at the other person with that sort of wrinkled nose, it is akin to saying you are no longer that important to me. You are dehumanized. You are something to be avoided.
Wow. Is this something that counselors and others use then? Are they aware of this?
There's a researcher at University of Washington who has published quite a bit on this. I don't know how much it's been adopted in counseling therapy, in part because it's not that look is causing the relationship to go bad.
Right.
It's just a symptom of what's already happened.
It might help the counselor see where they are on the spectrum,
it could,
right?
It could very well.
And come up with diagnoses. So liberals, conservatives, there's some correlation here. Where do libertarians fall on the scale?
Libertarians have luckily, we're just starting to do more research on the libertarian mind. But when you look at libertarians, they are not disgust sensitive. They do not seem to have they neither look like conservatives or liberals, as you might expect. And they do not seem to get the effects that we get in liberals and conservatives. That is, much like they say, they are often less moved by the emotions.
Well, and so and now Jonathan Haidt has done work on this as well, moral judgment and our sense of disgust and contamination. So where is your work the same and how does it differ?
So Jonathan and I have actually collaborated on this in our worldwide disgust and political orientation studies are with him and his collaborators. But where we differ is that he places an emphasis. He describes morality as a set of intuitions. And when you look across the world, there are people who have just a different set of what he calls moral foundations. So liberals and conservatives both think that justice and harm are really important to morality. But he says conservatives and, in fact, most people around the world also really care about authority, about group loyalty, and about this domain that he calls purity. And the purity domain is where disgust is sort of most active, that keeping you away from dirty things. Now, Jonathan does a good job of saying, listen, let's actually pay attention. These people are saying some things that they find honestly, genuinely like moral claims, and we can't just accuse them of being stupid. Where we differ is that I think that, in fact, we are sometimes okay saying, no, that is not the right moral, I want to reserve the right to say, if you believe that something is wrong simply because you gag at it, then you should reflect on it, and I think that a reasonable person should question that belief.
But of course, they're not going to say that. They're going to say, no, that has nothing to do with it. It has to do with all of these. And then they'll list a bunch of facts, which may or may not be true.
And they'll list a bunch of reasons. And in fact, you can get people into the lab and you can ask them these questions that show that, in fact, they will just cling to this belief no matter what. But the disgust does seem to be doing a lot of work. So it's really hard to convince somebody just in an experiment that their beliefs might be founded on something that's irrational. But one thing I always tell my students is, if you really think, say, that homosexuality is wrong because you're grossed out at the thought, let me just remind you about other things that are gross. So, for instance, two very ugly people having sex, that's kind of gross. Now, does it follow that you should legislate ugly people having sex? I don't think so. So make sure that you build your case on something other than that aversive reaction that you're having at the pit of your stomach.
But that gets to this big debate that we keep having about the everybody having their own set of facts, and that the conversation now in the public domain is nearly impossible because people who are perhaps moved by emotions they haven't examined come in with a body of facts that they consider unchallengeable, and they're not even the same. We're not talking about the same. We don't have the same foundation to begin the conversation.
Yeah, it often seems intractable. And what I do have a higher burden for my own students. So if you spend a semester with me, you better know why exactly you find bestiality to be wrong. You better tell me why you find homosexuality to be wrong. And you can't, the least I could do is make them challenge and think through this. And it's something that in public discourse is incredibly difficult to do.
So that's at the very least. Yeah. What you can do is examine all of the factors that have influenced any of your feelings and ideas about a thing. And if you would simply acknowledge that this irrational impulse was any part of how you came to this, might be the beginning of a turning point.
And I think that public discourse such as this really helps. If there's anything that this research can at least do is maybe some people don't realize that this is why they believe what they do. And upon realizing it, I am an optimist about people's ability to reflect. I mean, what makes us human is that we're not just pulled like animals by our immediate impulses and our emotional reactions. We are capable of reflecting on it. So I hope that people take it seriously.
David, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Pizarro, a psychology professor at Cornell University. He is currently the Gahan Distinguished Visiting Professor at Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill. And that's our program for today. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Sean Wen, Megan Mataferi, and Phoebe Judge. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.